Support for the BTPM NPR What's Next podcast comes from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, partnering with the community to pursue racial and socioeconomic health equity. Learn more at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
absolutely,
if we're uncomfortable
absolutely
talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
Welcome to What's Next from Buffalo, Toronto Public Media. I'm reporter Ijaz Jasil, and today we're talking about an underrepresented community, which is older adults whose voices are often missing from budget debates. And I have three guests here who will weigh in with their own areas of expertise. We have, from Leading Age New York, Sabrina Barrett, CEO of the organization; Hadley Horrigan, Vice President of Advocacy, Community, and Social Responsibility at Catholic Health; and Lisa Haglund, CEO and President at Heritage Ministries. Thank you all so much for joining the discussion today.
Thanks for having
us.
Absolutely. So the first thing that I want to get into is the why behind the what. And the what is, we've seen within recent years closures of many not-for-profit Western New York nursing homes. And I wanted to get into a little bit of why is that. Understand funding's a big issue. Can you elaborate?
Yeah, funding, to put it quite simply, funding is a huge part of the problem. When you have about 75% of nursing home residents are funded by Medicaid. And unfortunately, the Medicaid reimbursement rate only covers about 75% of the stay. So these nursing homes have to find a way to make up approximately 25% of the actual cost of care. We know that on average, our members are losing around $150 per day per resident. So if you think of a 200, 300 bed nursing home, that's hundreds of thousands of dollars a year that they're losing. And that's the reason why we've seen an acceleration of nursing home closures. At Leading Age New York, we've been tracking the data on how many closures are happening. Just in the Buffalo area, since 2014, we've seen 8 nursing home closures, but 4 of those have come in the past 2 years. So 50% of the closures, about 600 beds, have come in just the past 2 years alone. Mm. And we know that about 80% of the beds in our in this region are operating at negative margins. And that's a signal that we're going to see more closures if we don't see increased Medicaid funding for nursing homes.
I would add on to that, our rates have been set in New York State from 2007, and Sabrina's right with all of those points. But just to kind of anecdotally bring it home a little bit more, if we have 400 beds in our county and we lose over $150 per day, we lose $26,000 per day caring for really our loved ones that are going to be on Medicaid. All of us at some point will be there.
Yeah.
So we're struggling to find a way to stay open, to not put more on the hospital systems. But in real life, what that means is not only are we trying to find a way to stay alive and serve them, but we're trying to find a way where those seniors feel like they're treated well with dignity. They have activities. Things are not being cut from them. What you see happen most often is when nursing homes do stay open under this kind of pressure and don't dissolve, is that the services to the people we love the most, the seniors we love that are on Medicaid, start being cut more and more, and the quality of life declines and the health issues increase.
So I want to talk about exactly the role that nursing homes play in our society. I think a lot of times there are misconceptions that it's where you place older adults so that they can just spend out the rest of their days there, or it's where, you know, you put off a loved one if you just simply don't have the time to take care of them. But nursing homes really offer so much more than just, you know, they're not a last resort. They're really foundational institutions. And can you speak to the importance of them?
I feel like Hadley could add on to this a lot. But if in Western New York, here in Buffalo and all of Western New York, let's say that you had 100 Medicaid patients right now in the system that stayed in the hospital longer because skilled nursing homes are not available. If you're paying $3,000 a day approximately for a bed in a hospital after a hip replacement or a stroke, where the nursing home is only $250 per day that Medicaid gets reimbursed, there's two things happening. First of all, we're costing New York State Medicaid more by over $2,000 per day. For 100 residents, that's $450,000.
Wow.
Just within a month period. The second thing you're doing is a hospital is meant for clinical assessment, clinical treatment, then for safe discharge. Our role becomes the safety net to then offer therapy. If you've had a stroke and you can't use the left side of your body and you can't swallow well, to teach you how to walk and swallow again before you go back home. People everywhere think of a nursing home as I'm just going to go there to pass away. That does happen. We do have residents that have been with us 3 to 13 years, and it's their home, and it's our job to make it their home. But the goal is that we are a safety net for the hospitals to discharge safely so that they can continue rehabilitation before they go home, and that we cost less to Medicaid, not more. And I'm sure Hadley has things to add to that.
And when nursing homes close, it affects the whole continuum of healthcare. So let's talk about, you know, I show up at the, you know, the emergency department with my grandmother, Dolores, and we'll say that Dolores has COPD. She smoked for a long time, but, you know, she's had an illness. It's really taking a toll on her, and she's really short of breath. And we did the right thing. We took her to our primary care doctor first, and they recommended that she be taken to an emergency department. And when we go there, we see that we have a long wait, and we're wondering, you know, why do we have that long wait? You know, the role of our hospitals, Catholic Health operates 6 hospital campuses, 6 emergency departments, and, you know, every single person that walks into our door will be assessed, stabilized, and then transferred if required. And that takes time. But I might sit in the emergency department with Dolores because upstairs, you know, where people are admitted, folks might be waiting anywhere from, you know, 4 days to years to find a safe place to discharge. And what happens in that circumstance? Let's keep using Dolores as an example. So we got through our wait in the emergency department. She's taken upstairs because they want to keep a close eye on her. Things could take a turn for the worse. They want to put her on some IV antibiotics. And then she is starting to feel better. So she no longer needs that care in the hospital. She's ready to go to a nursing home so that she can get strong again. So they can give her physical therapy and they can make her strong again to go home. But we can't find her nursing home bed. So maybe she has Medicaid, and we're not able to find her a bed, so she stays in the hospital. Now, the hospital's not getting paid. Now that Dolores is designated ready for discharge, the hospital will continue to take care of her at a cost of about $1,000 per day, but we don't get reimbursed for that care. And then Dolores, while she's waiting there, her muscles get weaker. You know, she's more at risk of getting a hospital-acquired infection.
Depression.
Yeah. And then by the time maybe she does get to a nursing home, maybe she's now not strong enough to get back home again. So this has a real profound impact on the patients and their families. But you know what? It also has a huge impact on our caregivers. You know, my colleagues who are nurses and doctors and care coordinators, they want the patient to be cared for in the right place. And when they can't get the proper care, and something about the system is forcing them to not have their patient cared for in the right setting, the most appropriate setting, you know, that leads that caregiver to, you know, feel a moral injury as well. And then, of course, all these implications on the healthcare system in total's finances is could lead in this region, you know, to more challenges with access.
And if Dolores went home, and let's say she lived on the east side where there's issues with transportation, or in Jamestown, New York, at the nursing home, we're able to wrap services around her. We're going to bring in an occupational therapist. We're going to bring in oxygen tanks from WellCare. We're going to wrap services to help her heal. If you send her home without that support and that transition, the chances of her not meeting, being able to get to her appointments because there's not good transportation, because we don't always provide in these rural and underserved communities the equity and services they need. It is a lot of demographics that go into that, and it's heartbreaking. These are real people.
Yeah, and it's not just about Dolores. It's about her family. if you're having trouble discharging patients to the nursing home care that they need, chances are when you finally find a place, it's going to be far away from where their loved ones live, which makes it even more difficult for those folks to continue to see their loved one, to check and make sure, you know, that they're doing okay, that their treatment is appropriate, all the things that we want to be able to do for our grandmothers and our great aunts and our parents. So it really impacts not just older adults, but the entire community. And we already have a system in this area where nursing home beds are at 92% capacity. So losing more beds really will put even more strain on the system.
In New York State, since COVID, there's 7,200 fewer nursing home beds.
Right now, in my facilities, we're closing one and discharging residents, which is heartbreaking. But our other two, we actually have bed capacity usage restricted due to staffing and just wanting to give good quality of care and not being able to afford it.
Yeah, it's not just the closures. It's also these staffing issues. So, for example, you know, Dolores, I love that we keep saying my grandmother's name over and over and over again. Like, I really love this. So let's keep doing it. But, you know, Dolores might be ready to go home on a Thursday, but a nursing home might be pretty low staffed on a weekend, so they might not be able to take her. So that's three more days that she's in the hospital at higher risk for getting an infection, not moving her body, mm-hmm. and the hospital's not getting paid for taking care of her, so the hospital's losing on that situation. Dolores is in a bed that, you know, maybe Lisa here, maybe you had an elective surgery that we had to cancel on you. That's not good for you. That's not good for the hospital's finances. So this, you know, this all really compounds upon itself.
Right. So it impacts globally the entire community and the healthcare system.
Yeah. And you just brought up a point that I was really wondering about, how this impacts other patients in hospitals, because if there is a nursing home shortage and there is nowhere else for our elderly to go for care and they do have to opt for emergency services, what does this mean for everyone else who needs care at a hospital?
It means they're going to wait a long time to receive care. I think, you know, mm-hmm. recently ECMC announced some layoffs, due to the financial strain that all of us in this industry are feeling as a result of persistent Medicaid reimbursement gaps, but also, you know, pending pressures coming down from the federal government and the impacts of HR 1. But in that conversation about those layoffs, they talked about losing $25 million a year on patients who are like those that I mentioned, you know, the patients that have received the acute level of care that they needed in the hospital and are ready to go to somewhere else for a different level of care, but that place doesn't exist. And now in ECMC's case, you know, it's not just an elderly patient. You know, ECMC is caring, as just Catholic Health and Kaleida as well, care for patients with a lot of, you know, pretty profound social and substance use and mental health co-occurring issues that make it very difficult to place people, you know, which brings in a whole other conversation about, you know, equity and disparities in, mm-hmm. for different groups. But, you know, even at Catholic Health, I looked, and as of Tuesday, just on Tuesday, a snapshot in time, we had 31 patients who were ready to be discharged, ready to go somewhere else. Their home wasn't an option, you know, they weren't ready for home or their home wasn't safe enough for them. 31 patients who were ready to go somewhere else and had to wait. So last year, there were about 740 patients total in our hospitals in that circumstance, which totaled 3,997 days that we weren't reimbursed for care and that people were sitting and waiting to go to a more appropriate level of care.
And if I can add on to that, globally, if you start to study the hospitals, which is what I got into before kind of I stepped into this role as CEO at a skilled nursing facility, when the hospitals start keeping patients that much longer, not only does it stop you and I from being able to go in for elective procedures, when they start getting reimbursed less, it increases their loss. And that's when you start to see hospital closures or hospitals exiting certain lines of business, because each piece of this is a funnel. We're a cost containment. And when we back up the hospitals, we're actually going to end up costing the taxpayers and Medicaid more money in the long run. And we really need to get some advocacy and some understanding. There's a lot of narrative and it becomes very political, right? On do we need to cut Medicaid funding? Are we spending too much there? What about this? Who gets it? Is it the hospitals or the skilled nursing facilities? I don't think Hadley and I have that point of view. We know we are an ecosystem that can't survive without each other. We are asking the state to put aside politics and take a bipartisan approach to understand that all of us are going to be impacted by this. If we can't find a way, and ethically, it's also the right thing to do. We can sit here, and I drove into my car today with a full tank of gas, right? With boots that keep my feet warm. I can stop and get Chick-fil-A on the way home if I want to, because we don't have a Chick-fil-A in Jamestown. So, right, I'm really excited to be in Buffalo. I know there's a nicer restaurant, but I'll get some Chick-fil-A. And not everybody has that luxury, right? If you're retired and your money's not stretching as far and you're already on food stamps and you don't have proper transportation and now the hospital system can't place you someplace appropriately, it's not just about them losing money and possible closure and delay of right electives. It's now about, are you further away from your loved ones because your daughter lives in a three-story high-rise and can't get to see you? Now you're going to become depressed and your life actually ends. We had a resident say to us the other day, just take me out back and shoot me. If it's this hard to place us, because I don't have anyone that loves me that can take care of me. That is the most depressing thing, that she was formerly a teacher. She spent years giving back in our community. And this is what she's left to feel like.
Heart-wrenching.
Yeah.
If I can just say something a little positive, I think this is a topic, though, at least in Western New York and in the Western New York market, that we have really come together across bipartisan lines. You know, this topic, this idea of Medicaid reimbursement, especially for nursing homes, is an area where you'll see the provider community and the labor community, the labor unions and owners and Democrats and Republicans all singing the same song. I have to compliment our Western New York delegation, both sides of the aisle. Our New York Senate and Assembly members get this. They understand, obviously, how important the caregiving is that happens in these places, but what important employers, you know, the healthcare is in our region, and they really have been, you know, fighting the good fight for us.
Amen.
Yeah.
As have our partners in labor.
Communities and hospitals need thriving nursing homes. That's just the bottom line. I am well aware of all of the financial stress and strain that our hospitals are under, and absolutely, they deserve the funding that they need. But what's different between hospitals and nursing homes is that hospitals do have other payer sources. Nursing homes really rely heavily on Medicaid. So when the Medicaid funding rate is inadequate, when it's only covering 75% of the cost, it's really hard for nursing homes to find a way to make up that 25%. Some of them have relied on foundations in the past, grants, churches, but that funding, they have been stressed financially for so long that funding has dried up. So I agree that our elected leaders are supportive. We are really grateful that Governor Hochul, in her proposed budget, has put $1.5 billion in a fund that she has said should be for hospitals and nursing homes. That's really good news. As much gloom and doom as we've kind of been talking about, there is a significant path forward for some relief for our nursing homes and for our hospitals. And we're hoping that the final New York State budget will allocate half of that $1.5 billion to nursing homes. So $750 million would go a long way in helping with this situation. The budget also contains about $4+ billion other dollars for hospitals, which is great. Wonderful. We're not asking for half of all that hospitals have been allocated. We're simply asking for half of this one piece, this $1.5 billion. And like I said, it would really go a long way in helping us keep beds open, keep doors open, staff properly or even better than, you know, it's so competitive right now to be able to retain and recruit staff. And as my colleagues were saying, compassionate staff are so important. We don't want to have turnover because our residents get used to that compassionate care. They get to know their caregivers. They become their extended family. I travel all around the state and I've talked to residents who have told me that the caregivers in their lives have actually saved them. I talked to a former truck driver who, when he was admitted to the nursing home, refused to eat, didn't want to get out of bed. And he told me that this caregiver that was there with me that day, he said she convinced him he needed to live. He needed to eat. He needed to get up. I've talked to spouses of residents. You know, it's got to be, I can't even imagine coming to the point where you realize as a spouse that you can't provide the care that your wife or your husband need. And so you have to take them to a nursing home. But I talked to a husband who said, the staff here make my wife smile. He's like, I can't even do that anymore. He's like, but they make her smile. And so it really is more than just a place to go and receive medical care. It's activities, it's community, and it's caregiving. And that's mission-driven nonprofit nursing homes. And that's what we're trying to save for our community.
That is why advocacy is so important right now. And I want to go back to not the place of doom and gloom again, but just addressing something that is a very real concern. And I do want to get into it very quickly before we go to break here. But you mentioned about when that patient, the elderly patient, is ready to be medically discharged, but there is nowhere for them to go. Realistically, what happens to those people?
Our care coordinators, I was speaking with one of them yesterday, and we keep them. So if a patient is in a Catholic Health hospital and they don't have, their home isn't a safe or appropriate place for them to go, and we can't find a nursing home bed for them, they'll stay with us. And so that's why last year, you know, we had 3,997 bed days filled with people who no longer needed the level of service provided by our hospital, but we're still taking up that bed, being cared for by our nurses and staff, being fed by our dietary and talked to and cared for by our environmental service employees, because there was not a safe place for them to go.
And there are some times where the resident will choose to leave. They don't want to stay in a hospital that extended length of time, or a family member may pull them out. And then they go home and it may not be the best environment for healing. They don't have the services. They don't have an ability or a way to get to doctor's appointments. We hear all the time, and I see this. I saw this with my own in-laws, right? I sit on a committee in Chautauqua County where, like, they give out $25 gift cards to get women to maternity appointments on time, to get the proper health care, because people are working and they're doing the best they can and they miss them. Well, my in-laws are different age bracket, right? But they went home and went right back to, and it wasn't completely safe. So now we have fallen in the bathroom and we're going to call for another ambulance ride, and we're not going to eat healthy, and we don't have a way to get to the store until I get out of work, right? And there becomes greater depression, greater anxiety. There becomes a lot more health issues. It all starts kind of compounding, and then they're right back into the hospital, and we're increasing cost and decreasing the bed availability. It is, so there are avenues from my perspective. This Governor Hochul putting together, you know, the budget and addressing the need, it's not just about funding, right? It's about all of us working together and being innovative, because when they leave the hospital or they stay there too long, whether they go to the nursing home and then they leave, there are complete ecosystems and structures that we have to work on to make sure that especially people who don't have the same equity have to live their life to the fullest and the healthiest. And we owe that to our communities.
Absolutely, especially when you talk about, once again, the older adults being underrepresented, and then you get into the subcategories of underrepresentation, the people who live in the areas with transportation gaps, yeah, with, you know, maybe low incomes, all these sorts of things, the disparities, which we will be getting into soon. But just going back to what you said about the emotional impact, I know this is something that's a big deal, not just for the patients, but for their families as well.
Yeah, I can't imagine being, you know, a child of an older adult, and you're trying to raise your own children while at the same time make sure your parents are receiving the kind of care that they need. It's a strain on all of our families, and especially if you are low income, in a place where transportation is hard to come by, you're struggling every day just to get your own self to your job, to get your children to the schools where they attend, to make sure they get to all of their activities, their own medical appointments, get your own groceries. You add into the mix concern for the safety and well-being of your elderly parents. That just adds to the stress and the strain that those families are under. And so when you have a situation where you know your parent is ready to be discharged from a hospital, but you can't stop your life and lose your own income to stay with them 24/7 or make sure they get to the appointments they need to get to, you really rely on that safety net of community-based services to ensure that there's proper care for your family members. Also difficult is, let's say your parent does get placed somewhere, but it's an hour, hour and a half from your home. How do you go and visit them? How do you make sure that's part of the depression and part of that person being able to thrive in their environment, just knowing that their loved ones are able to come and visit them and be with them?
We are talking to Sabrina Barrett, President and CEO of Leading Age New York, Lisa Haglund, President and CEO of Heritage Ministries, and Hadley Horrigan, Vice President of Advocacy, Community, and Social Responsibility at Catholic Health, today on What's Next.
We are discussing the impact of closures of not-for-profit nursing homes across Western New York. And one of the things that we were discussing was the effect that these closures have on families, and I want to get more into adults stepping into unpaid caregiving roles. What's the economic toll that this is taking on families? We talked about emotional, but it's also hitting, you know, the wallets of many families. Let's get into that.
I can start with just a personal story. When I stepped into this role, it was 4 or 5 months into the pandemic in 2020. I have 4 children. All were in between middle school and high school at that point. I became CEO in the middle of the pandemic. And my husband's parents, who lived about 20 miles away from us, were both aging and not doing well. Our father-in-law had already had some strokes, so personally, I experienced this. He had been at our Heritage Village facility, which is a skilled nursing facility we're closing right now and discharging residents and staff from. And we were able to get him home. He really just wanted to come home. That's all he wanted. And we weren't equipped for that. So we had therapists come out to the house. We were able to spend the money to get him home, to make the bathroom accessible after a stroke. We ended up bringing in hospice, but we had to pay for care. The care ended up increasing to be 24/7. And while Medicaid only reimbursed the skilled nursing, at Heritage Village, we got reimbursed $212 per day for his care, which is interesting that I would know that, but I run it and my father-in-law's there. Mm-hmm. For home care, we paid about $20,000 a month to have someone 24/7 there. It was sustainable out of his retirement for about a month and a half. It was not something that could keep going forever. He ended up passing away, and then unexpectedly, his wife, they had been married for almost 60 years, just gave up. And 90 days later, she was in our other skilled facility, Heritage Green, and ended up passing away there. So my grandchildren watched both of their grandparents die within a 90-day period. Mid-pandemic, I was trying to navigate running a staff, 4 children, going remote learning financially. The guilt, and I had the financial means to do it, but the guilt of not being there enough for my mother-in-law, and what if I had gotten her to an appointment earlier? What if we had been able to get into the doctor instead of doing a remote visit? The financial drain, we missed off and on a ton of work between the two of us, and we're working nights and taking turns doing shifts, going down there at midnight, she'd fall, hiring someone, going down to the nursing home once we had her in there. It was almost unmanageable. Not paying attention to our children, missing events, missing, you know, supporting them in remote schooling, all those different things. If you have any sort of, then you're adding to it financial barriers, or you can't get into your mental health counselor, or your kids are maybe starting to do drugs at the age of 16, right? You don't have transportation to get from one place to the other. It would be completely unmanageable.
I think I would add, you know, you're telling your story, Lisa, but you're also someone who's intimately familiar with a long-term care system. You understand it. You know how it works. You know who to call. Imagine families who don't understand it, who all of a sudden they have a parent who has a stroke or a significant medical event where they require more than just, you know, short-term care. How do you begin to navigate that?
Yeah, there are so many barriers, I can imagine. Yeah.
Exactly. Just applying for benefits, figuring out, you know, it takes a while for those benefits, even after you've applied, to go into effect. And if you're calling all around and you're, you know, you're missing work because you can't leave your parent, they need immediate help. So if it's stressful for somebody like Lisa, who understands the system, imagine what it's like for the rest of us who have no idea. Or, and I think that's the thing I want to impress upon most of the public. None of us want to think about long-term care, nursing homes, assisted living. We don't want to think about needing those services until we're really forced to. And because of that, most of us aren't aware of the crumbling long-term care system in New York State. It's really falling apart. And it's happening at a time when more people are needing the services because our population is growing older, and at a time when our workforce is shrinking. So the need's only going to increase, the number of caregivers is going to decrease, and the ability to navigate the system is going to become even more difficult. So, you know, I appreciate Lisa's example, and I can't help but wonder, my goodness, what about the, you know, people who aren't connected in some fashion to the system? And it really sheds light on why we do need to eliminate as many of these barriers to care as possible.
Absolutely.
And when you get into those barriers of care, there are even more in certain communities and sub-demographics. When you talk about the rural community, when you talk about low-income households, some communities of color, how are certain groups of people being especially disadvantaged with what we're seeing right now?
We all got excited about that one. It's good we're passionate.
The inadequate Medicaid reimbursement in New York has in and of itself created disparities. So our care coordinators are trying to find a nursing home bed for patients. And, you know, as not-for-profit nursing homes, mission-driven nursing homes have closed, you know, they've closed either, we've lost those beds entirely, sometimes they've been sold to for-profit providers that often run, you know, lower star-rated facilities. And it is harder to place a Medicaid patient because, again, of that, you know, the lack of payment. You know, I can sort of give you an example. Catholic Health, we're a big health system. We have six hospital campuses, clinics throughout, you know, Niagara and Erie County. We have home care. We have four nursing homes. So we're a mission-driven nonprofit. We have four nursing homes. They're all five-star rated. So five-star CMS rating means that our patients are seeing nurses more hours per day than average compared to other places in the country or the state. It means that our patients are having fewer bed sores and, you know, pain and antipsychotic medications used at a lower rate. You know, our patient satisfaction levels are higher. So, you know, that's what that means. And it's really expensive to provide that level of care. So Lisa's given examples. One of our nursing homes, St. Catherine Laboure, it's the only five-star facility in the city of Buffalo. And at that facility, we spend over $350 a day taking care of our residents there, but the state's giving us $234 a day to care for them. And so what that means at St. Catherine Laboure, where patient satisfaction is high and it's a five-star rated facility, where we have, you know, 20 patients at a given time who have zero health insurance at all, and they're still receiving that five-star care, that means that 1970s building looks every bit of out of the 1970s. You know, we've
That's
hit
true.
You're getting the care is excellent, but the building is not. And that's what's happening too, is that as this reimbursement, you know, of course we're going to put those dollars into direct patient care, but what suffers then is the physical plant. And our patients there deserve the dignity, as do our workforce, of working in a place that is at the same level as the care that's provided in those buildings.
Yeah, absolutely. I spoke to one member who has, like, in the past 2 months had to close a nursing home in the Utica area. And they had to, even before that nursing home closed, they had to take a wing offline because the heat was broken. They didn't have the funding to fix the heat. And you can't put people in beds that aren't safe because they're not properly, you know, heated. They're not warm enough. And so that's another aspect to the closures, and it's also funding related. So entire facilities close, like what's happening with Lisa's facility, but also parts of facilities close either because they can't afford to find enough staff or because they can't make the necessary repairs to ensure a safe home-like environment for their residents. And the other thing that I think we haven't spoken to is, when you talk about strain on families, I would be interested to hear Lisa talk about what it's been like to talk to families about a closure. And I can't imagine getting a call that the nursing home that my grandmother or my mother is in is having to close and what that means in that situation. So I think that's another part of the strain. As we see more of these closures happen, you're finding our very compassionate caregivers having to do all that they can to relocate residents to a safe place.
I think two things before I talk about the families. I would talk about in Buffalo, especially in the city, in Erie County and in Chautauqua County, we have centers. Statistically, I was just trying to look at some of the statistics where poverty is increasing, right? You probably have more than 100,000 from what I can tell from the last census draw in the inner city of Buffalo where seniors, and it's dramatically increasing for seniors. So if poverty is increasing for all sections, especially of certain demographics, seniors are being hit even harder. They don't really have the means to go out and, right, I'm going to pick up an Uber run, right, and do a side hustle to get an extra $80 to offset this. So, you know, you think about you and I, if the cost of eggs and the cost of this and gas is going up and electric is going up, as poverty levels rise, that is really impacting our Medicaid and our Medicare, and especially those that are dual eligible. And it impacts both of us. And really, to Sabrina's point, we've been talking with the families. We are down to probably our last remaining 9 or 10 residents at Heritage Village right now as we work on discharging them. We've had town hall meetings with all the families. We've met with them one-on-one, and it's been indescribable. Everybody, I'm trying to psychologically figure out how to connect the gap of people, you know, on social media all day long and can talk about when you run into them out to dinner, well, all the nursing homes are closing. And then when the nursing home really closes, there is a shock factor. We have one resident that had lived there for 13 years. Every single other resident that we are discharging that has been with us have been a longer stay. Our shorter stays have left already. And so there are people that have been there for 2 to 3 years. The family is dumbfounded. They're crying. The residents are crying. They're heartbroken. They're facing having to go to Olean, to Salamanca, to Batavia, to Buffalo. And some of the families are so grateful that we were able to stay open as long as we could in spite of the challenges. Others are really angry. And the thing that breaks my heart is they're really angry. We're the face of that, right? If we had done a little bit better, worked a little bit harder, we're already, my maintenance teams, we don't have money to hire people to plow anymore. So we shovel, we paint, we're selling scrap. We're going to the churches and asking for help. So I watch our teams who are bleeding so hard because these residents have become their family, and I'm going to get a little emotional, also being blamed if you had just done this better or that. And it's just heartbreaking.
There's so much that people can't see in terms of what is done, and that's where the stress comes in, especially with underfunding. As you mentioned, there are so many other areas of slack that U.S. providers have to pick up.
Yeah, it's amazing. And it's grown since the pandemic. So I think what was slightly manageable, and we found ways around it before the pandemic, has become so much harder after that. We've seen it escalate tremendously. Food costs have gone up. So do you remember like a year ago, like no one could find turkeys around Thanksgiving, and it was like a big hullabaloo, so we probably all ran to Wegmans and got a turkey, and we could do that. As a skilled nursing provider, we're passionate as a non-for-profit of making this like their home. We want you to have a Thanksgiving meal. Well, we can't get turkeys in unless we're paying double, and we can't even afford what they cost regularly. So then it's really our team getting together and saying, okay, can we go to the local churches? You know, you're trying to run a business with 600 employees and deal with all these tax laws, implications, payroll, benefits, and then all of a sudden you're spending half your day trying to find turkeys that you can afford and finding people to help pay for them, and we're all chipping in. Okay, I'll drive 2 states away and I'll get these to make sure our residents have something. It's making sure that you have blenders and food warmers because you have people that have had a stroke and can't swallow the same way. It's facing a family square in the eyes when you've had staff call off because they just can't do it anymore. And they've been yelled at all day long. And then, you know, they got hit. And now we can't even, you feel like you're not doing enough ever.
That's definitely a hard situation to contend with. And, you know, you all have mentioned a lot of points about affordability being an issue, and then also other points about the cost of living increase. As our groceries and utilities and everything continues to go up, a lot of people are trying to get more resources where they can. But if someone maybe makes just a little extra money or gets a slight increase on their pension and they lose their Medicaid eligibility, they lose that assistance with long-term care. What does that mean for people who realistically can't afford with their own means to receive that care, but are no longer getting that assistance through Medicaid because they just overqualify?
I can't speak to the insurance side, right? So how do you, you know, how do you deal with if you hit that roadblock where you overqualify? From my perspective, this is where I talked about earlier, that kind of ecosystem. There are solutions. So, you know, I'm giving a sad story, but there is so much hope. I wouldn't keep plugging along every day if there wasn't so much hope. And I do feel like all of us care enough to make a difference. But the solutions have to come from all of us actually stepping out and finding out what the struggles are and coming alongside of people. Because if someone does fall into that bracket where suddenly they lose that coverage, they've got to be connected really with an insurance expert. That's not even me, even though I do this all day long, who can walk them through with their health conditions, with the pharmaceutical needs they have. This is going to be how you're either going to regain it in a year, right? Or this is going to be the alternative and how much it's going to cost. And then honestly, it comes down to, for that person, are you cutting your cable? Are you cutting your cell phone bill? It's heartbreaking. So if you get to that point, you're not worried about then your dentist appointment, because that might be a $200 and you're putting off. I actually have someone right now that I'm dealing with and working with their family member who is not getting their heart medication because it's $600 a month. Well, where is that going to land them? So I'm really passionate about when this funding does come out. The hospitals tend to be a lot bigger than we are. And I am so thankful for the hospitals, because we couldn't do what we do, right? And there wouldn't be a need for us without the hospitals. But they are bigger. Everybody knows that the hospitals need the funding. I think people tend to look at nursing homes a little bit more skeptically, and rightfully so, right? You have to have accountability and you have to have high quality of care. We have to demand that, but we also have to do things differently. We have to have half of that funding, not just as a bailout so we survive for another 5 years. It's so that we can start partnering more with hospitals, partnering more with home health agencies for a safe discharge, bringing in insurance experts and doing seminars so people can learn. Can you imagine if, like, you brought in an insurance expert and they talked about, or a senior elder attorney, they talked about, here's how you navigate that system. And there were education pieces. If our public libraries, if we all started working together, if there's a new robot that does snow shoveling. So instead of me shoveling, I'm not saying that because I don't want to shovel anymore, although I don't, right? You had a robot doing it, and then the staff you do have is able to make a better meal or paint a room to make the resident feel like home. But we all have to start working together, which I think we are doing, and we need to use that funding wisely when it comes through. There are subject matter experts out there, and we have to make it more accessible. Our local libraries can be holding aging seminars. I'm really passionate about that, because one of the big things is telehealth, and that drives me a little crazy. I am a huge proponent of telehealth for me and my children, but I would advocate for everyone to go into my skilled nursing facility and try to help a 92-year-old with dementia use telehealth. Yeah. Or a 92-year-old living in an apartment complex who doesn't know how to, right? My kids are already starting to make fun of me because we get a smart TV and it's smarter than me. And I'm like, why do I have two remotes? What's happening here, right? So if we're going to do those things to make things work better and cost less, we have to have training on them, and we have to educate and equip people.
Absolutely.
We talked a little bit before about the physical plants of our facilities being neglected as we've invested limited resources in direct patient care. But it's really hard to innovate and change mm-hmm. when in your duress. Margins are negative.
When you're just surviving.
When you're in duress.
So, yeah. You know, I talked about our 5-star nursing homes at Catholic Health, the 4 of them. They collectively lose about $13 million a year. Wow. Catholic Health as a whole, I think, ended, 2025, $24 million in the hole. You know, you need ideally a 3% margin to invest in equipment and your facilities and to do innovative things. And we've been operating at negative margins, you know, the whole continuum.
Could you imagine if you partnered up with some cities in Buffalo and I partnered up with our local hospital in our two or three neighborhoods in Jamestown and we had a community garden like Disney does and you feed your own people and you reduce food costs by 1%. There are things we can do together to help the community and the hospitals and the skilled nursing facilities. But we have to have the funding to start doing that. You can't just, we under duress, we cannot continue to innovate and operate in this environment.
It's true. A lot of good ideas, but we need the money behind those good ideas.
To get it started.
Absolutely. And I do want to get into solutions. But before that, I just want to dig a little deeper into this issue and the impacts of loss of long-term care. We're also losing other resources in the region from dental to mental health, things that all of us rely on, but including the elderly population who's already facing a loss with nursing homes and other forms of long-term care. Can we get into the impacts of how these greater losses are impacting the aging community?
Absolutely. In Western New York, and hopefully some of the state I have, you know, I might be a little bit off because I didn't look at it before I came here. But in Western New York, dental health professionals, the last time I looked, only 1 in 3 accept Medicaid, and they prefer not to. So they'll take all the other types, Medicare, right? Private insurance first before Medicaid, because Medicaid pays so much less for the same procedure. 1 in 6 mental health care professionals actually accept it. And so when you're driving down the street and you see someone in the cold weather outside walking around, talking to themselves, maybe they have no place to go. We are so quick as a society to just keep driving. But the real issue is we do not have enough resources, and it continues to decline in Western New York. I believe with working alongside of Governor Hochul, we have some expertise here that we really can help position us to, in a period of 10 years, we're having a different conversation than this one. But we need to have those doors opened. We have to be able to be heard. I think we need a little less politics and a little and some more actual representation from people who are doing it every day and who see the challenges. We are in a medically underserved area in my county, in Chautauqua County. Buffalo is faring a little bit better, but that doesn't mean it will continue as Medicaid rates remain stagnant and Medicare actually sounds like the better of the two, but because it hasn't kept up at pace, it's quickly becoming like Medicaid. We're going to see less and less providers in Western New York overall. So, and I think we have to become a destination for staffing, for innovation, for health centers, and for community solutions. That's what we're known for as grassroots.
True. Very true. So I'm interested in learning about how is what we're seeing in Western New York comparing to what we're seeing statewide. Sabrina, I think this may be a question for you.
Yeah, I'm happy to answer that. At Leading Age New York, we've been watching closures for quite some time. And I wish I could say that we were faring better in other parts of the state. The closure crisis is statewide. We have 72,000 beds across the state that are operating at negative margins. And that's a key indicator, meaning they're losing money. And that's a key indicator of closures that are coming. In the last 2 years alone, statewide, we've lost to closures about 1,200 beds, which represents about 20 to 25% of the total closures we've seen in over a decade. So it's definitely accelerating. The rate of closures is increasing. And we're losing our best nursing homes because they're the ones that are spending the most money to have those full staffing and high star ratings that Hadley was referring to. The state puts out a list of high quality nursing homes. Even though nonprofit nursing homes are only 33% of all of the nursing homes in New York State, 75% of the high quality nursing homes on that list were nonprofits. So our nonprofit nursing homes and public nursing homes are among the best of our nursing homes. But since that list has come out, many of those homes have already closed or have been sold to for profit. So we are losing the best of our nursing homes in New York State, which means the quality of care is only going to diminish and it's going to become even harder for you to find good care in your community for your loved ones.
So this is quite an expansive issue. And as was mentioned earlier, the aging population is growing, the caregivers are shrinking, as is, you know, the facilities that are equipped to give the proper care to our aging population. When we look at who needs to be advocating for them, it's probably the people who, as you said, aren't thinking about it right now. You know, like, oh, I'm not going to be 75 anytime soon, or maybe my parents aren't. But it's realistically going to come a time where you have to think about the effects of Medicaid, the effects of the closure of not-for-profit nursing homes. How can people become more aware so that they can properly advocate for the residents of our community who really can't advocate for themselves?
I'm going to give a plug to Leading Age and say that Leading Age has an amazing website that is so simple, or even their Facebook page or LinkedIn. If you go on there, you will see a simple posting that if you're 50 and can just share it on Facebook, it will talk about Medicaid funding. It'll talk about how reimbursement, and it's in such a way, you guys have done it in such a way that even I'm not a financial guru, like it just makes sense. So I would advocate to looking at Leading Age website and or their LinkedIn or social media page, sharing some of those resources. I would advocate for, there are several places you can go right online, and you can just type in aging services, the crisis of skilled nursing home crisis, the Medicaid crisis. Just read a little bit one night, you know, and scroll through and look at a little bit of it. And then even our website for Heritage, you can go on, there's pre-made letters that can be sent to your senator, your congressman. I believe Leading Age has supplied those to all of us as well. Yeah. I think making your voice heard, if your community has town hall meetings or town hall calls with your assemblymen, call into those and ask about Medicaid and are they supporting seniors? Medicaid at a political level tends to become this big discussion, right? About Medicaid and funding and the budget. We want to make sure that we're somehow carving out seniors and under equity and making sure we're having those discussions. I don't know if you would add and change on to that.
I appreciate the plug. I would say more to come. We recognize that this is an issue that many New Yorkers don't want to think about. I don't want to think about it. I don't want to think about growing old. I have this image of my head of reaching my 90s in a rocking chair on a porch and sipping, iced tea or something like my grandmother did. But I also want to live in a place where we are caring for our most vulnerable and where we have choice, so that when we get to that point, that our long-term care system is robust and innovative and thriving instead of just barely hanging on, so that when I get to that point for my parents, for myself, I can age in the space that makes the most sense for me. I want that for myself, for my loved ones, and for all of our communities. And I think we all should want that. And so even though it's a very, it's a topic we don't want to think about, we must think about it, because this problem is only going to grow, and the time for action really is now. And we have a path forward for some significant relief in the current state budget proposal. And that's really what we need to push for right now.
And so to Sabrina's point, actually, maybe that's one of the best things people can do. Take 10 minutes this week, Google something, get educated, vote appropriately, make a call. If you type in my local legislators for your county, it'll bring up all their phone numbers. Make a call, make sure they're voting and pushing for this vote on this budget. One thing we tend not to do always as Americans that I'm really passionate about is when you look at the voting numbers, people don't vote. Vote. When our senators, our assemblymen, they're all voted in by us. They work for us. They have public numbers. You can send an email. It would take 10 minutes this week to read one article, learn a little bit more, send an email or make a phone call and ask for this money to be allocated to nursing homes. If we underfund nursing homes at this point, Medicaid, it doesn't save money. It shifts costs to the most expensive part of the system. And the question really before lawmakers right now is simple. Do we want to pay more for worse outcomes or invest wisely and prevent system failure? And if 500 people listen to this and made a call, that's 500 people that probably have not made a call or an email to their senator and assemblyman in the last year.
Into the governor's office.
Yes. Yeah, I always forget about that. And she's from here.
Yeah, exactly. Tell Governor Hochul thank you for allocating $1.5 billion for nursing homes and hospitals, and please make sure that half of that funding goes to nursing homes.
I will say, if I just once before I hit, in the next 10 years, if I could see as many social media posts about our seniors aging, just one day, as I do about the Buffalo Bills, and I love the Bills, right? It would just make my heart happy because I think we all care a little bit more about our grandparents.
Absolutely.
Than a football game.
Absolutely. So more work to do still, but good to know that there are ways that we can all be advocates. Lisa, Hadley, Sabrina, thank you all so much for being here today and joining me for this very important discussion about elder age care and what we can do to really keep an eye on what's going on right now. This has been What's Next. I'm Ejaz Jasil. Thank you all so much for listening.
Support for the BTPM NPR What's Next podcast comes from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, partnering with the community to pursue racial and socioeconomic health equity. Learn more at hfwcny.org.